Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gunnar Tindberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, it's a terrific honor and pleasure to have as my guest William H. Gass. He's in the studio, the Clayton Studio, in St. Louis. The occasion is the publication of his new book of essays, Life Sentences from Knopf. Anyone who knows Bookworm knows that I'm an admirer of William H. Gass, both of his extraordinary fiction, which began with Omen Setter's Lock and moved on to a collection of short stories that's still being read called In the Heart of the Country, a novel called The Tunnel, and he's the author of essays, literary essays, that take my breath away. They include the famous Fiction and the Figures of Life, Finding a Form. The most recent are The Tests of Time, A Temple of Texts, and now Life Sentences. Because he is an exquisite examiner of sentences, which are, after all, the unit out of which fiction, philosophy, even thought itself, when articulated, are formed, I thought we would hear from an essay the aesthetic structure of the sentence. You know, Gass has been writing essays so beautifully, so well, and for such a long time, that these essays now have reached a point of abstract perfection that steps toward not only the beautiful and truthful, but somewhat of the ecstatic and even blessed lunacy. And the aesthetic structure of the sentence asks us to think about a salesman at the door. Nothing more than that. At the beginning of the essay, it's an encyclopedia salesman, so that sentence takes place in the Great Depression. This sentence is about a Fuller Brush man, William H. Gass.
Well, thank you, Michael. I'd just rather hear you say nice things about me.
And I love to.
The shabby suited fellow at the front door was a Fuller Brush salesman. The rhythm of the sentence not only propels the sentence forward, it helps to organize its significant units, its phrases and clauses. The reader is made not merely to see the sentence, but to sound it, because it is now a small mouthful. These sounds are usually not those of ordinary speech, but the spectral mimicry of things that are said to the mind, heard only by the mind, in the arena of the mind, in the subvocal consciousness that exists during reading. This salesman's sentence, which is, "The shabby suited fellow at the front door was a Fuller Brush salesman," seems quite sure of itself. It is direct, it is definite, it has no room for reservations. Yet without altering a word, its epistemological and ontological status can be radically altered. That is why I call these verbal instruments transformative operators. For instance, we could lower the sentence's degree of assurance. "I thought that the fellow at the front door was a Fuller Brush salesman." "I guessed that the shabby-suited fellow at the front door was a Fuller Brush salesman, but Gertrude was of quite a different opinion." Amphibulously, Harold said that if the shabby-suited fellow at the front door was a Fuller Brush salesman, he was a monkey's uncle. Or change tone and attitude. "I certainly hoped the shabby-suited fellow at the front door was a Fuller Brush salesman. Otherwise, I'd have just now bought a cat's brush to comb my beard." "The shabby-suited fellow at the front door was a Fuller Brush salesman, But what if he were also the exhibitionist who has been frightening the neighborhood? More radically, we can put it in another realm of being. While seated before the fire in my dressing gown, reading Descartes' Meditations, I dreamed I heard a knocking. Then a cuckoo popped out of its clock house to announce that the shabby-suited fellow at the front door was a Fuller brush salesman. I realized, when I was awakened by my desire to answer his knocking, that I had been dreaming inside a dream not altogether mine. Layers of reality, degrees of uncertainty, ranges of attitude, levels of society, depth of contextual connection, modulations of tone, the ramifications and complexities of concept, and, above all, the vocabulary of the denoted world must be taken into account, managed, and made the best of.
That's William H. Gass reading from his essay, The Aesthetic Structure of the Sentence. Now, you're using that sentence as a toy, the way you'd say, take a nickel, if there are still nickels, and spin one on its edge and watch it, you know, twirl. What I find fascinating is that having used the sentence as a model, you then show us what it's like in a work of literature to see the master, and in this case it's Henry James, twiddle with a basic unit until it becomes wondrous and full. And now we're going to hear William Gass reading a phenomenal sentence from the late Henry James from The Wings of the Dove.
Yes, this passage occurs at a moment when the narrator, in effect, is sizing up the house he is about to enter, the way we frequently do, by measuring the language of the objects that are in there. And that's one of the things that's interesting about this passage. It was the language of the house itself that spoke to him, writing out for him, with surpassing breadth and freedom, the associations and conceptions, the ideals and possibilities of the mistress. Never, he felt sure, had he seen so many things, so unanimously ugly, operatively, ominously, so cruel. They constituted an order and abounded in rare material, precious woods, metals, stuffs, stones. He had never dreamed of anything so fringed and scalloped, so buttoned and corded, drawn everywhere so tight and curled, everywhere so thick. He had never dreamed of so much gilt and glass, so much satin and plush, so much rosewood and marble and malachite. But it was above all the solid forms, the wasted finish, the misguided cost, the general attestation of morality and money, a good conscience and a big balance. These things finally represented for him a portentous negation of his own world of thought, of which, for that matter, in presence of them, he became, as for the first time, hopelessly aware. They revealed it to him by their merciless difference.
That's William Gass reading a passage from The Wings of the Dove. What stuns me, by the way, at the end of the passage, is it's the material world, the ugly and overstuffed furniture, that reveals to this narrator the immaterial world, that he has a mind, that thoughts have their place, and that they flee from the material. Here's Gass with his commentary on the kind of passage this is.
There is no dimension of the sentence that is not operative here. from the upper-class Latinate word choice, the steady interruption of qualifying phrases, the carefully constructed climax, the shocked tone, both dismayed and outraged, the repetitive encircling of and so, and the helpful disclosure, as if for use in this essay, of the language, both in its syntax and lexicon, of the world of human things, the single teacup that speaks of former wealth and dashed hopes. For Henry James is as much a master of that language as he is of the urbane style of verbal social exchange with which he was daily engaged. There is no more attentive prose than one of the master's sentences, a quality of what any one of them sees or feels is not only meticulously depicted, but placed in its proper sphere and hefted for its proper weight and seen through, realized, and measured as though each object were a little scene inside a glass globe with snow that will obediently fall when its world is turned upside down. I have suggested in other places that such sentences as these are containers of consciousness, a verbal consciousness, of course, one built of symbols, not sensations, yet one of perceptions all the same. Perceptions followed by thoughts like tracking hounds and infused throughout by the energies of memory and desire, the moods emotions foster, and the reach through imagery and other juxtapositions of imagination.
That's William Gass reading from the final essay in his book Life Sentences, an essay called The Aesthetic Structure of the Sentence. A wonderful subject, because often my friend Bill Gass is misunderstood by even make-believe friendly critics who want to say that his point of view is that the world is made of words. This is the revelation of Gass. This doesn't surprise us. Now, in fact, what I think he's saying is that the relationship between sentences within a paragraph, between that paragraph and its ideas, those ideas and the world, that world and the world of the story and what it means, more than meaning, what it's about, that the relationship amongst these things is what fiction is about. And talking about that relationship is to talk about fiction more clearly, more precisely, more meaningfully than to talk about morals and symbols and themes. Am I sort of in your realm, Bill?
Yes, I think so. There are so many languages at once that one is trying to manipulate. There is a huge set of languages that we have outside our normal thinking selves, the world and its activities and its little intimations, its conversations, how one little thing will signify so much other little things, and so on. That part, on one hand, and then the constant travail and movement of thought through one's own head and the application of a language, third place, which has been built over centuries by the use of people in certain ways to bring all of those things together and make a vision of the world, which is going to be, in my sense, not direct, as you might get in science. Even there, you build a model. But sort of a metaphor for life. James's world is not to be found anywhere in the world. It's too wonderful for that. It's too precise. It's too organized. It's the way it ought to be. So to call my interest or thinking that the world is made of words is a silly, but it the world is made of words that we use to make it look that way. And then the novelist comes along and employs other things to build a model for it.
Now, Bill Gass once thrilled me by answering a question about how it was that he took 35 years to write his novel, The Tonal, by saying that he writes very, very slowly and that he rewrites and rewrites and rewrites only to attain mediocrity. Now, that's the way we should be reading, too, isn't it?
Well, yes. But, of course, I have to first say it wasn't 35. It was only 30.
Thank you.
And it was probably not 30, but only 25. But it was a long time. We were always taught when I was a kid, speed reading. And I was one time the speed reading champion of Ohio.
Not really. Truly?
Yes. We used to have competitions, and you read as fast as you could, and then you answered questions, and it was kind of test. And I did very well at it and was learning absolutely the wrong things. Unless you read junk all the time, then the sooner you get through it, the better. But now to learn, had to relearn, and philosophy helped in this way, but to relearn how to read slowly, but not with difficulty, as if you couldn't read faster, but rather slowly to savor, to try to understand out of all the choices that, say, James had in making a particular paragraph. There's so many words that could have been used. And every time he uses one, he takes away his chances to use others. Until finally he has a system of words put together there that is almost indestructible because you can't change anything without ruining everything. And the reader has to be counting the bricks because they weren't just hurled into the wall. They were fashioned and polished and assigned their position.
Now, you've spoken of how sometimes we can not only hear the word that's been chosen, but the ghosts of the words that haven't been chosen, that in a good passage, those bricks may surround certain holes in the wall that represent choices we can feel, but ones the writer decided not to make.
Yes, that's very much the case, too. You can particularly notice this when you have a fairly well-defined environment and it's sort of evident that a certain number of terms would naturally fit in to the situation, and then something comes along that is unexpected and transformative in terms of what your chances are, what you might decide to work over.
We're always hearing ghosts when we're reading, not just the ghost of what the writer left out, but the ghost of what the writer heard, so that, you know, from time to time, when a writer is making an allusion to another work, it's the wall talking about a part of another building.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah. Working with, in fact, if you're a writer who is well-read, and not all of the good ones are, But the similar situations, similar maneuvers have taken place. The ghost of Henry James, of course, is always with me saying, oh dear, that will never do, as you're trying to write.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with William Gass about his new book of essays, Life Sentences. We'll continue after this short break.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with one of my true living heroes, William H. Gass, about Life Sentences, his collection of essays that talk about not only reading and writing, but also the basic building blocks of literature, the sentences themselves that make it up. But I was thinking about the opening of The Wings of the Dove. I remember that it began, and I'm working just from memory, she waited, Kate Croy, for her uncle to come, but he kept her unconscionably. And when we hear that, we know it's not Kate Croy waited for her uncle to come. It's almost, it's the first sentence of a novel. You can sing it. Yeah. She waited, Kate Croy, for her uncle to come, but he kept her unconscionably. And if it's because of Gass that I hear those hard C's, come, but he kept her unconscionably. And they're ascending C's. And the 87-year-old William Gass, I'm happy to tell you, has announced that a new novel will be published next year called Middle C. Here in this book, Life Sentences, you've got essays on Gertrude Stein, on Proust, on Nietzsche, on Kafka, on Lowry, on Henry James, of course, John Gardner, Katharine Ann Porter, and Knute Hansen. Now, there are writers who don't write with this degree of attention. Are they the writers we're meant to neglect? Do your insights not apply to them? Where is the rest of fiction, in your view?
Well, no, I think much of a fine writer's attention is automatic. He doesn't have to be, he just grew up that way. It's a part of being a writer and paying attention. One example, Katharine Ann Porter was writing brilliantly in her first story. I don't think she improved a whole lot as she went on, but she didn't need to. She was somehow unconsciously or adapting and developing her work, sure, with difficulty, but not as if she weren't paying attention. And the same is true of a lot of other writers who are just, Stanley Elkin wrote fast and furiously his first draft and then crawled back over it carefully, taking care of the... I can't write that way, that's all. That makes sense, you know, to write, get it all down, see the whole. But I don't see anything but a whole if I'm trying to do that.
While everyone is talking about how it's harder than ever to be published, I dare to disagree. I've been being sent an unprecedented number of first novels that seem to have been published as quickly as possible to get them out in the world before the end of the world occurs, and to have been written as quickly as possible. And I feel sort of the way I felt when I read only yesterday that the Encyclopedia Britannica had announced that it couldn't compete with Wikipedia, that there will be no more editions of the Encyclopedia Britannica. And I felt, Well, yes, okay, I understand, but it's kind of the end of a world.
Yes, well, careless writing and careless books, you know, books are written to look careless, too, because the reader doesn't want to feel threatened by the difficulty. Glibness is good. It goes with greed is good, I think.
We've got another of your favorites, Gertrude Stein, in fact, about whom Katherine Ann Porter wrote some perfectly, brilliantly nasty
essays. Absolutely wonderful. See, this is proves a point, though. I adore Gertrude, but she has her flaws. And Katherine Ann Porter was all over them. And wrote about it so with such wit that you want her to be right for the moment. But in fact, you know, Gertrude is unharmed and goes on being obnoxiously in the way of tons of people. I like her for that, too.
We're talking with William H. Gass. He's recently collected Life Sentences, a collection of literary judgments and accounts. It's published by Alfred A. Knopf and recently put into my hands, gobbled up, reconsumed, because each of these essays appeared in magazines. You can't read William Gass too many times or too often. I'm very grateful to you, Bill, for having come to talk to us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Life Sentences at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. Alan Howard is my associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. The engineer today is Philip Richards. Special thanks to the recording engineer, Keith Filges, at Clayton Studios in St. Louis. And thanks to Craig Thine. I want to once again thank the 87-year-old and magnificent William H. Gass for coming today to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.